Hi, I'm Ryan Meeks, and after years of trying to make life work as a struggling artist, independent filmmaker, and musician, I thought to myself, hey self, wouldn't it be helpful to ask other artists how they're finding their path in this world? And so now, that's exactly what I'm doing on a bi-weekly basis. Welcome to The Path of Art. Welcome to The Path of Art. I'm your host, Ryan Meeks, and I'm here today with Alyssa McCusker. She is now the curator at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. So that museum up on the, at the University of Utah with all that great art inside it, she is the curator for it. So welcome to the show, Alyssa.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
It's great to have you on. And so you're a curator. And so a lot of times, I mean, for me, when I think curator, you know, I think of the person, you know, with the swab that's swabbing all the paintings, making sure that they're cleaning it. And so what is a curator? What does that job entail?
Okay, well, the term curator and to curate actually comes from the Latin for to care for.
Okay.
So I am the steward. Now in this new role at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts, I'm the steward of, with my colleagues, not just me, but of a collection of over 20,000 objects.
Oh, wow.
Ranging from all over the globe and in all different kinds of media, essentially everything you can imagine, from ancient artifacts to digital works that were just made a few years ago. So everything in between. Actually, my role as a curator is not being there with the cotton swab cleaning works of art,
right,
but with a team assessing when that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And we have conservators and collections managers and registrars who also work with us in that kind of care and maintenance of individual objects. So,
and so as the senior curator, mm-hmm, so what is your role in that process?
So I'm honestly still learning what that is and defining that with my colleagues. The outgoing senior curator, shout out to Whitney Tassie, who did an amazing job for 10 years at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts, actually just left. Our time overlapped somewhat this summer. But she was a modern and contemporary specialist, and mm-hmm, I am certainly not that.
Oh.
I focus on the Renaissance.
Okay.
So I'm the new curator of European and American art. So mm-hmm, I really focus on what we would term sort of the old masters, capital O, capital M. But I oversee a department, mm-hmm, as the senior curator, as well as, you know, holding that role of curating American and European works. And we have right now in our department another curator who has been there for over 20 years, Luke Kelly. So mm-hmm, he is our institutional memory and just this amazing knowledge bank. Thrilled to work with him. And he you know, dabbles in a lot of different areas that have sort of needed coverage while those roles haven't been filled. But we are looking eventually to fill another position, which will be a modern and contemporary person too. So eventually we'll be a department of three.
So they kind of need a curator for specific genres or for specific time periods, mm-hmm, of art.
Yeah. The way the field of art history is, we are trained in specific areas. So I'm actually trained in Northern Renaissance. And a lot of people assume I mean Milan. No, there was a Renaissance outside of Italy. So I actually focused on Germany and the Netherlands, the Low Countries. So, just the way that we're trained is we become specialists and we sort of have to work our way back in some ways to being generalists when we get into curatorial roles, because most museums in this country are not large enough to accommodate a whole team of curators that specialize in just one or two areas. So,
right. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that there's a lot of research that goes into curating and that curators have a lot of say of what pieces go up during a show or what kind of show you're doing. Mm-hmm. So how does storytelling play into that? How does storytelling play into that?
Yeah. I mean, storytelling is really, that's essentially what we do as curators, curating not just specialized exhibitions on a subject, you know, coming up with what is the main sort of thesis, what is the main idea we really want people to take away from something. But then within that, you know, sort of sub themes, and that's how we end up organizing exhibitions a lot of times is that, for example, I curated an exhibition about women in Japanese prints, and some subsections of that were, well, what were different roles for women that were represented in Japanese prints? And those ranged from mothers to oftentimes sort of old women, to witches or kind of witch type figures, and then courtesans, you know, because of the you know, prominence of what's the culture I'm trying to think of? Ukiyo-e. How do you pronounce it? I can't think
of
it.
I'm not even sure of
the floating world and Japanese courtesans and things like that. Okay. I'm not thinking of the term right now. But, you know, lots of different roles that were in many cases sort of strictly defined by women. And those roles sort of set up telling a story, a larger story about women in Japanese culture in especially the 19th century. So, yeah, I mean, it really is about it's about storytelling. And that goes also for our more permanent or long term installations in the museum. So if anyone tries to tell you that museums are completely objective and have no bias or no prejudices, they are not being honest to what we do. These are human curated.
Right.
We all come with biases and prejudices and...
Well, and I'm sure that they all want to tell a unique story, right?
They do. In some cases, you know, many curators have spent years of their lives focusing and studying on one particular specialization that we just talked about. And they want to showcase that to the world. And sometimes that's a detriment. Sometimes it's beautiful and amazing, but other times it's, you know, they're not seeing the bigger picture of the whole history of art. So
what are some of the most noteworthy pieces that you've had the opportunity to be a curator for?
Well, going back to actually even before I was a curator, some of the most important works that I have worked with were when I was doing my Fulbright year in Berlin. I had the unique, wonderful delight of being in Berlin for 10 months and studying the portrait drawings of Hans Holbein the Elder. And that was the subject of my dissertation. So that kind of firsthand work sort of just kind of cemented my desire to really work in a museum someday. That's really what I wanted to do, is to actually work with objects, not just digital images, teaching on a screen, with occasional trips to museums or to collections to study.
There's really something to be said about experiencing art pieces physically.
Yeah.
Right?
So we sort of talk about this as the aura of the object, but there is most certainly a power to, in this example from Berlin, to sitting down in front of these drawings that I know 500 years before Hans Holbein drew, probably into a small booklet that he carried around with him, judging by the size of these portrait drawings and kind of the sort of quick, sketchy manner of their drawing and things like that. So there's an aura to the object. We certainly talk about that. And that's the power of a museum, too, is that in our museum, we're preserving, as I said, over 20,000 objects, and we have 20,000 opportunities to make a connection with each person that comes in, whether that be, you know, them coming and visiting the galleries or coming in as a scholar to study things in storage. And there is a power to that. I mean, I certainly believe that.
Yeah.
You kind of get goosebumps. I still get goosebumps right. in some cases.
Right. I can only imagine that. So one of my favorite artists is Caravaggio.
Oh, man.
I love Caravaggio.
How do you not love Caravaggio? He's so amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my thought, too. Yeah. And when I tell people about Caravaggio, and they have no idea who he is, right? Yeah. Like, he's kind of like Rembrandt, but he tells better stories, in my opinion, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, if I were to see one, I can only just imagine. Like, I'm even getting goosebumps just talking about it. If I ever got the opportunity to see, like, the Calling of St. Matthew, I would jump at the opportunity to see it.
You should go to Rome. It's still in situ in the chapel. And, yeah, you've picked an amazing one because...
It's an amazing, my goodness. Sorry. I love that painting. Yeah. I love his style. Mm-hmm. I just love all of it. I just, you know, family, travel money, you know, the same excuses that everyone has, right?
It's life. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's move on to this other question that I had.
Sure.
I want to know about your art. Do you do any art on top of the curation? I mean, you obviously had to get art education, and at some point you mm-hmm. most likely did some art yourself. Do you create art?
Most of the art I create right now is like lots of stickers and collaging with my 6-year-old son. So I do have an arts background, and I actually mm-hmm. started out in the arts in high school. I was very fortunate to have to go to a public high school in Minnesota. Cannon Falls, Minnesota. Shout out to everybody there. With a very strong arts program. And I had two amazing visual arts teachers, Mr. Kahlo and Mr. Getman. I still remember you. and so that's how I started out and got interested. And I've kind of done a little bit of almost everything mm-hmm. because of that strong program. And then... in college, I did a minor in studio arts, and that was specifically in intaglio printmaking, which is copper plate printmaking.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So etching, engraving. Mm-hmm.
I have a friend that does that locally, actually.
Wonderful.
Yeah, she's really good at it.
Wonderful, yeah. Also with my major in college, we were required to do studio arts courses. But I decided to do a minor and do some extra courses in it because I really loved printmaking. I loved ceramics. Mm-hmm. Wheel thrown ceramics are kind of like almost like meditative kind of practice. But I have not done that much since
you've
those experiences in college. Yeah.
Right,
I paint at home occasionally. Mm-hmm. I draw, but yeah, now mostly as a mother, it's...
Do you find any parallels in curating that still relate to that creation process? And what would those be if you do find those?
I do. Because I think, I'll just say, I think where the parallels are is that both of them are a practice. You know, you'd have to do it in order to get better. Mm-hmm. And you have to be willing to take the time and do the work, and it has to happen organically. You can't force it.
Right.
And that's where I think the parallels are.
So the creative process is still very much involved.
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that we talk about storytelling, which is, you know, absolutely essential to what we do as curators, but there's also, we also are presenting a visual display. Mm-hmm. So elements of design, you know, we talk about sight lines all the time mm-hmm. in museum work. You know, what do you see as you come into a gallery, and what's going to capture your attention? Mm-hmm. What kinds of colors will work you know, with a certain work of art that's displayed.
Also, where to place your crown jewel of the gallery, right?
Exactly. Where, you know, where would we put that amazing Caravaggio calling of St. Matthew if we could ever borrow it?
I don't know what it is, but I so love that painting.
It was a revolutionary painting. I completely understand the appeal for you. I mean, when I was teaching art history survey courses, that's what I taught when I introduced Baroque, because it really completely changed the narrative of art.
It really did.
It did.
It really did.
Yeah.
So how does a curator's perspective differ from that of art viewers and also those that are creating art, like mm-hmm. that are painting and drawing actively?
Mm-hmm. So I think as curators, I mean, as art historians, we're really looking at how does something fit into the larger history of art. What aspect does a work of art really draw on from history, or what is unique about a work of art? How does it stand out from that history? And I think, you know, artists are, and many artists engage with the history of art. That's certainly true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they're engaging with it in a way that to them is, you know, visually and intellectually stimulating, and they can kind of do whatever they want, which is artistic license, right?
Right?
That's why we have that expression.
Yeah.
But for curators, I mean, we really are trying, I mean, for, in my opinion, a curator that's worth their salt is trying to educate.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to, you know, illuminate why a work of art is important, or why a movement in the history of art is important, why a culture is important, or a counterculture in some cases is important. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to take that artistic interaction with past and present and then put it in some kind of context that mm-hmm. makes it meaningful to the viewer, the visitor that comes into our museum.
And creates an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, it is very artistic that you're creating an experience for both the viewer and those that are creating art, creating inspiration.
Yeah.
Right?
I believe so. I really do believe so. And I work with, you know, it's not just up to me to come up with these decisions. I work with a great crew of designers at the museum too. And
mm-hmm.
these are decisions that we sit down and deliberate about, and we talk about, we discuss. So nothing is just sort of haphazard or random mm-hmm. when you come into the UMFA.
Planned.
It's certainly planned. It mm-hmm. is deliberate. Yeah.
All right. So we're going to go to a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Alyssa McCusker, the senior curator at the UMFA up at the University of Utah. And we're going to go into kind of her past when we get back. And we're just going to see what inspired her to get to where she is and what little nuggets of information she learned along the way. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Path of Art. I'm Ryan Meeks, and we're here with Alyssa McCusker. She's the new senior curator at the UMFA. And Alyssa, I wanted to ask you, what got you interested in curating? We kind of touched on what curating is, mm-hmm. but what got you interested? Like, so you were going to school for art, and what just kind of pulled you into it?
Really, I was so fortunate in high school to... I already mentioned these amazing visual arts teachers I had. One of them also, Mr. Kahlo, taught a humanities course, actually co-taught with an English teacher. It was a 2-year humanities course, the first half being ancient to medieval, the second, or actually prehistory to medieval, the second half being sort of Renaissance to contemporary. And that was literature, history, art history, sort of all combined for 2 years. And I was so fortunate that as a 17-year-old, I was able to go to Europe for 3 weeks with a humanities class trip. And mm-hmm. my parents paid for me to go and do that, when I know that that was really difficult for them to afford. And something that they're not used to. So I come from a working class background. My parents did not go to college. so the idea of sending me off to Europe for 3 weeks and kids, this was back in the day when you couldn't just WhatsApp my mom and dad and be like, everything's fine. You know,
that means there was a disconnect there.
There was a huge disconnect. It was very expensive to call. So, you know, I sent them a postcard and actually returned back to the States before they got the postcard. So, I mean, it was really it was a challenge for them. And I'm just I'm still so grateful that they did it. But it was 2 weeks in southern Germany and 1 week in northern Italy. And that was it. I mean, I went and saw works of art, some of the most amazing works of art in the history of Western art. You know, the things that stood out to me were seeing the Alte Pinakothek in Munich, seeing Albrecht Dürer's self-portrait from 1500. He painted when he was 28 years old. Y'all should go Google that right now because it's a stunning, one of the most stunning self-portraits in the history of the world and very complex and interesting. But then going to Florence for a few days on this trip and walking into Santa Maria Novella in the Dominican Church in Florence and seeing a fresco painted by Masaccio of the Trinity and seeing that as a fresco, it's painted into the wall,
right?
So it's still in situ, of course, where it was intended to be. But just seeing that in person, it's such an essential work in teaching the history of the Renaissance because it's one of the first it's one of the first compositions which totally employs a linear perspective, scientific perspective. Mm-hmm. And that was just it. I was like, I need to work with art somehow. I need to do this somehow. And I realized that I really wanted to work with objects directly.
And so that got you kind of just pulled into wanting to work. I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, seeing these things in person.
Yeah.
There's a magic to it,
it's
right?
It's absolutely magical. Yes.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what pulled you in to being, to wanting to take care of these precious objects.
Yeah, absolutely. That, and I, you know, because I, you know, I mentioned that I come from a working class background and I had these experiences and at sort of every step of my education, whether it was my undergraduate and then my master's and then my doctoral work, I kept pursuing ways to engage with this material firsthand. So I mentioned that my dissertation research was a year in Berlin where I went to the Kupferstich cabinet. I could go at my leisure, really, and I went almost every single weekday to study portrait drawings and other works that are in that amazing collection. So I've sort of created at each step these opportunities for me to engage with this material firsthand. And, it's still, and I do it because it's still just so powerful. It is truly awe-inspiring in a way that I think, you know, when we see images that are coming back from the James Webb telescope now, seeing the cosmos, you know, in these clear images for the first time,
and
it truly is awe-inspiring.
And it also makes you think, what kind of art is that going to inspire?
I kind of can't wait to see.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you came from a working class family and your parents didn't go to college. That's very similar to my background as well. Was there any point where you were told, like, what? Were you ever told what a lot of people that want to go in the arts were told?
Yes.
Don't do it.
Of course I was.
All right. So how did you deal with that?
Actually, I do have to give my parents credit. They didn't say just don't do it. But it was more like, what are you doing? What are you going to do with this?
Which is a passive aggressive way of saying don't do this, right? not saying that your parents are passive aggressive.
No,
actually, they're wonderful people.
Are amazing people. But good Minnesotans, yes, they were a little bit passive aggressive. But it was, you know, I mean, they at least gave me the opportunity to kind of answer instead of just being like, you're ruining your life, which is what some people get.
Right.
And that's unfortunate. Yeah, they were, I think they were very worried about what I was going to do. They were worried how I was going to make a living and, you know, my parents actually were not museum goers. And, you know, the first time I went to a museum was because of my high school best friend. Her mom took us to the Minneapolis Institute of Art and the Walker Art Center, which are two really amazing museums to go to for your first time going to a museum. So not having had that kind of familiarity or just even that regular experience of going, you know, just museum going, my parents really didn't know that this was a whole field where you can actually not just become gainfully employed, but you can find really, truly meaningful work. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I struggled for a long time to convince them of that. And fairly, I mean, it's a very competitive field right. that we're in. There mm-hmm. are very limited jobs. And so it was, I mean, now that I'm a parent, I feel very differently about it. I mean, if you'd asked me about this 25 years ago, I would have probably been very frustrated with my parents at the time. But now I understand it was, you know, they're wanting to protect me, wanting to care for me, wanting me to have a happy future and not being sure about if that was possible with what I was doing.
Was there any point in time where you started to doubt yourself and the decision to go forward in it?
Oh, my goodness. We're going to start talking about, we're going to talk about the grueling slog that is graduate programs mm-hmm. and imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. yeah, which is I still have. I mean, I still sort of drive up to the UMFA and I'm just kind of like, I can't believe this is my job. I mean, this is my mm-hmm. dream job. It really is that I get to work not just in a museum with such an amazing collection, but also that it's an academic museum. It sort of bridges my two passions of working with art objects and teaching. And then also that I get to work with such amazing people, you know, people who are really committed to a vision, not just sort of collectively coming down from the leadership, right, but actually as individuals. The colleagues I work with are very passionate about our mission. Mm-hmm. And work very hard. We strive together to try to uphold our mission. And it really is a dream job, I have to say. And it's been a hard road to get here. I mean, I'm 42, and it's been challenging, and I've learned so much along the way. But yeah, there certainly were let's say valleys
to
that
cross.
Were very difficult. Right. Yeah, in getting to this point. But now that I'm here, looking back collectively, it's really all worth it. So, you know, just building that kind of confidence in myself, realizing what is important to me in the work that I do and the colleagues that I have and how I work with other people. Sometimes you have to, I think, take a few hits in order to figure that out. And that's, I guess, just life. I mean, it really is.
So what were some things that pulled you, like, what were some successes mm-hmm. or some victories that pulled you through kind of those doubtful times?
Well, I worked very hard to get where I am, right? And I can talk about that. And people like to refer to what my degrees are and things like that. And so those are all there and those are all on paper and that's fine. That is what it is. Yes, I did work hard to get here. But I did have incredible support all along the way. And at each stage, I would say at every stage of my education, I can point out one teacher, at least one teacher, as well as one, at least one friend that really got me through all of that. So, I mean, having a support network, I mean, that was the only way that I was really able to do it. Mm-hmm. No person is an island, right? We cannot do this by ourselves. And so, like I said, at each stage, having one teacher, at least, in some cases more than one, that believed in me and really said, you can do this. And, you know, or you're doing amazing work. What do you think about the next step? You know, you really could pursue this further if you want to. That kind of encouragement, I mean, I think for some teachers, they maybe don't realize the kind of impact they can have on their students' lives. But I really benefited from having teachers at every step of the way that were true mentors. Yeah.
And what are the difficulties that having a family brings into your career? I mean, having a family, it adds more, you know, to the plate.
Yeah.
And so what in your experience has having, because you have a child.
I do.
Do you still have a support group that helps, you know, your family? And, well, actually, you're out here in Utah now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that support group is probably far away now. So
yeah.
How are you moving forward? You know, I mean, you're obviously moving forward just fine, but how, what are some of the challenges that are brought up by having a family that you need to support as well as, doing an artistic career?
Mm-hmm. So, I would say some of the challenges are, I mean, we all face challenges in balancing work life. You know, there are entire podcasts dedicated to this. I'm sure you're familiar enough. So we all sort of face these kinds of challenges. For me, it's the I mean, what's difficult is, and this is sort of going back to your question about, points where I felt kind of down, right, in my path, or like things were really challenging. I have to continually remind myself that I'm doing the best I can in both areas of my, you know, motherhood or family life and work life, because sometimes I do feel that one suffers for the other, or that all across the board, I'm not doing my best at any of them. So just because, I mean, the significant demands of time, and my son is 6 years old, and, you know, he's not really at an age where he's independent yet, of course. And so, I mean, just balancing time, balancing mental and emotional capacity is probably the most difficult thing, I would think, because when I start to really get into my work, I don't want to say that it's like I become manic or something like that, but it's energizing, right? Mm-hmm. And I become really focused on it and really intent about what it is that I'm doing, so much so that I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and I immediately start thinking about whatever it is I'm doing. And that's exciting, and it's a productive sort of point in my work. But it also means that I'm maybe losing sleep.
Right. And that can cut into the time you have with your child.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, he's my only child and will be my only child. And I'm entirely dedicated to him and to, you know, for him to have, to give him everything I possibly can. And so to feel like I'm not doing that sometimes is really hard, as I'm sure it is for every parent. You know, we're trying to balance so many different things at once. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel that sometimes I have two things that are so important to me, you know, my family, my children.
Yeah.
And then creating things, creating music, creating art. And you're right. You get, you get sucked into art because you have to.
Yeah.
To do it right. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that means you have to sacrifice time with your family.
Mm-hmm.
And I am constantly just bouncing between the two, and it's sometimes just hard to have your head on straight.
I would say, to add to what you're saying about, that you feel this pull, right, to focus on your work. It's also part of it that's challenging too, is that I know that for me, my work is an important aspect of who I am, what I do. And so a happy mom, a fulfilled mom also means, translates into a happy kid and a fulfilled kid. And so trying to find that balance between my time to do my work and my time to really dedicate to him. Sometimes it's tricky. Yeah.
Yes. I think that's the perfect word for it. It's tricky.
It's complicated.
It's tricky.
Yeah.
But I think it works out in the end.
I do.
I think it does.
I do. Yeah.
So.
And I think the fact that, we're even having that conversation as parents is an indication that, clearly we're aware of it.
Right.
We're giving it our attention. We're thinking about it.
And we're actively trying to make sure that we're devoting time to both.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
I agree with that statement.
Yeah.
And what would you say to someone say someone out there is listening to this and they happen to want to be a curator?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say? I mean, what kind of advice would you give to that person if they're just starting out in college and they want to take this path that you've taken?
I would say, work hard, of course, study. It's important to follow your passion, and if this is really where it's leading you, then do the research to find out what it takes to get there. And in many cases, it requires most curatorial positions now require you to have a doctorate in art history or in some kind of related field, whether it's history or archaeology, whatever it is, whatever different area you're going into as far as curating. One thing that I would recommend to young people, if we're talking about somebody in college or, maybe even coming out of high school or something like that, language. Study language.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you are already absolutely certain that you're going to focus on American art since, since 1700 or something, and that's really what all you want to do. Language may not be as important if you are a native English speaker, but in essentially every other aspect of art history, whether it's the subject that, the art itself that you're studying may come from a context in which the language is different and you need to read archival documents or you need to read artists' letters or, contracts about a work of art in a different language. And the interpretation, the actual art historical analysis may be written in a different language. The current scholarship may not be in English that you can find. So language is key. And the younger you start, the easier it is.
Correct. Everything.
With everything. Yeah. And for some people, language is difficult. Some people, they really just pick it up and it just sort of, they have a facility with language, which is, I'm sure, still being studied by, neurobiologists of how that actually works. But for some people, language is really difficult. And having a basic facility with a language of just being able to have a conversation is not what's going to work. You need to actually, be able to read in a language, and sometimes read in script that is not, Times New Roman.
Right.
We're talking about handwritten documents from history.
In another language.
In another language, in which sometimes their penmanship is not the best either.
Right.
So, yes.
I know that if anyone ever reads my handwriting in the future, they'll just throw it away. Not where they won't be able to read it. So what is, so let's move on to this next question that I have for you. What's next for you? What kind of shows are you doing up at the UMFA? What is next in your life?
Well, learning a collection of over 20,000 objects.
They have a lot up
there. Takes some time. So that aspect of my work is really almost like sort of a daily or weekly trying to familiarize myself with the collection. But part of the way that we do that as curators is to, you know, have a project and to really dig into it. And so, you know, curating exhibitions from the collection is something that I'll start working on sort of in earnest. But for the time being, you know, the museum plans out its exhibition schedule or special exhibition schedule about 3 years in advance. So as coming in as the curator in July of 2022, a lot of the sort of schedule was planned out already. And so really I become a facilitator or it makes it sound so administrative. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, the exhibitions we have planned already are already curated. The objects are chosen. Mm-hmm. In some cases, the text is even written, the interpretive text for the labels. And so it's my job to present that in our space. You know, how do we accommodate this particular story in our space? And make that meaningful to people coming to visit the museum. So coming up in February, we're opening the first show that I'm really have kind of taken over the helm, right?
Okay.
Which is Many Wests. And it's a project that has developed out of a relationship with a consortium of museums in the West, along with the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And it's thinking about the history of the Western United States and how different artists have responded to that, and specifically contemporary artists, and trying to represent a wide swath of the demographic of the Western United States. So people of color, indigenous artists who are reflecting their experience of the West. So not just what we typically see in sort of art historical surveys or what we call the canon of art history,
right,
which are many white or European or first generation white American men traveling to the West and painting beautiful vistas, which of course we have here. We have plenty of those here. But the West is a much more complicated history than that. So that's what this exhibition really deals with. And then going forward, we are hoping, we're in very serious talks and are hoping to have an exhibition next fall. So less than a year from this time, actually, on the Samoan tattoo tradition.
Oh,
yeah.
Very interesting.
It's called tatau. And really engaging, not just, you know, with the material, with the photographs of these tattoos themselves, but really thinking about the local community here of Pacific Islanders in the Salt Lake City region, and, you know, bringing community involvement into that to tell a richer story about that tradition. And then after that, let's see. For the longer term future, we're looking at an American Impressionism exhibition.
Nice.
And then a Himalayan art exhibition. So those are more kind of longer term, out in the future, but they're coming eventually.
All right.
Yeah. So really trying to get into different areas of the global history of art. You know.
All right. So where can our listeners keep up to date on this stuff?
Yeah, we have a great website. It is umfa.utah.edu. And every different aspect of the exhibitions I've talked about will be shown there. News updates. We have visiting information. We are happy to have two free days, admission free days each month. Hey. So the first Wednesday of every month.
That's a night out.
And
so yeah. That's a free night out right there.
Yeah. And the third Saturday of every month is also free. And it's when we tend to focus on, you know, family activities and programming too. Mm. So
okay.
We see you. We want you to come. on our days when you can, you know, when you can access it, if that's, you know, a challenge for some people.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. It's been great getting to know you and talking just about curation in general. I've learned a ton. I hope this was helpful for those that are listening. If you're interested in becoming a curator, this was just a great opportunity to understand more about it. So thanks for listening, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right. We'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening to The Path of Art. If you or someone you know is creative and would like to tell your story, reach out to me at rmeeks@ksl.com. I might feature you on the show. If you liked our conversation, please make sure you follow the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. It really does help people to discover the show. Also, make sure you follow The Path of Art podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.